I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to the Agora Podcast Network's The Exchange. I'm your host, Tom Daly. This episode, I'm lucky to be joined by the hosts of the Lands of Leviathan podcast, Peter Sleeman and Brock Rademan. The Lands of Leviathan is one of my favorite hidden gem podcasts because of the substantive and simultaneously silly way they test drive real-world socioeconomic or political concepts and philosophies in the fantasy worlds of popular culture. This conversation was coordinated across three continents and bridged something like a 13-hour time difference. And despite the ludicrously early hour it had me up at, it was great fun. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And without further delay, follow me if you will, through the looking glass, to the lands of Leviathan. Peter and Brock, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, mate.
I'm glad to have you, because having you guys on to talk about Lands of Leviathan actually gives me an opportunity to talk about two of my favorite things, besides history, politics and nerd stuff.
Well, now, we're glad to hear that. It's well, that's two of our favorite things as well.
That's awesome. Now, I guess this is sort of a confession for me, because, believe it or not, despite the fact that I've successfully attracted a mate and produced viable offspring, I do self-identify
well
as a nerd.
You give us hope, Tom.
Well, that's what I'm here for. I'm here to shatter stereotypes. You know, really, though, I love, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Song of Ice and Fire, DC, Marvel Comics, all of that. And that's part of, you know, what I think makes your show so great. Obviously, you guys, too, self-identify as nerds.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. So let's start there. So what were the fantastical worlds or stories or characters, you know, that captivated you guys when you were young that put you on this awful track in life?
I remember Peter telling me once when we were having a debate, we were trying to work out what stimulated his intellectual mind, and he confessed in his young years, he spent a lot of time watching the Teletubbies, and these far-fetched creatures really entertained him.
No, that is not what happened at all.
What happened, Peter?
I'm too old for the Teletubbies. That stuff is, it's past, I'm too old for that stuff. I got into nerdy stuff because my dad had the original Star Wars on VHS, and we had like a big collection of VHS tapes because I was born in the mid 80s, and obviously technology came to South Africa a little bit late, so we were still, I mean, up until the age of, I don't know when we started watching like DVDs and stuff. But, I mean, we were watching VHSs for most of my childhood. And we used to watch the original Star Wars. And that was even before George Lucas released the edited versions.
Yeah. God, those guys.
So, I mean, and we watched, because, yeah, like, I'm sure you remember the VHS tapes. Like, they just got destroyed when you watched them too much. And we used to watch them all the time. I mean, I could like quote Star Wars from when I was a kid. My dad loved Star Wars as well. But also my dad was big into, you know, the hero's journey and a whole bunch of different philosophy. And he was also into like science fiction and stuff. So I also grew up reading fantasy and science fiction. I was reading Isaac Asimov and you know, the Foundation series and Arthur C. Clarke and Dune. I remember reading that. And also Terry Pratchett, because I was big into fantasy. And obviously The Lord of the Rings. Although I have a horrible confession to make, is that I didn't... What year did the first Lord of the Rings movie come out?
2001.
Was it 2000? So I must have been about
2001.
2001. So, oh no, actually, it must have been about like 14, 15 then. I hadn't read the books because everybody told me, like, while I was growing up, that the Lord of the Rings books were super boring and, like, just not to read them. I don't know why people told me that. It's ridiculous. And then when I watched the first movie, and we got to the end, and spoiler alert for guys who hadn't got there, and Gandalf falls. I said to my mom, I was like, so what happens to Gandalf? Like, that guy can't die. He's a wizard, man. She's like, you have to read the books to find out. And then I started reading the books. I was like, these books are awesome. I have to read these.
I'll see your story. I'll one up you though, because not only had I not read the books, but I took my brother to watch, to the theater when we were young. And, we saw the preview for this fantastic fantasy movie that was going to come out with orcs and wizards and hobbits and everything. I thought, this is great. We're going to buy tickets. We'll be first in queue and we'll go watch this film together. So when it came out, we went to watch Lord of the Rings. And we had no idea it was a trilogy. So, but when we got to the end of the film, we see, after three and a half hours of sitting in the same seat, we see these two hobbits staring off into the distance watching Mount Doom spew lava. And we're like, But why does the movie end now? You haven't even gotten there yet. What's going on? I want my money back. And that's when my uncle told us, no, it's a trilogy, you idiots. It's, you're supposed to go and read the books first and then get an idea of what's going on. So so complete ignorance on my part there, but also shared the love of Star Wars from a young age through my father as well. In fact, our VHS tapes were so worn that we could only rely on the audio. So we painted a big piece of cardboard black. Sprinkled some silver glitter over it, like stars, and we positioned a video camera in front of this black piece of cardboard, so it looked like it was looking at the galaxy with all the stars there. And we modeled our Lego craft on all the spacecraft that we'd seen in Star Wars, and we played the audio in the background. And as the scenes played through the movie, we flew our model ships across the screen, so that the camera picked up our Lego interpretation of the story. Huh. And we so enjoyed that we learned the lines and we learned the characters very well, and we got some Star Wars books and Star Wars Lego when that came out. So that was pretty much the start of the science fiction era for us. And of course, J.R.R. Tolkien just stole my heart with that trilogy. And I still haven't read The Silmarillion. So that's...
Oh, man, that's good stuff.
Yeah, I've read that.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Oh, one, okay, Brock, I think you win with modeling Lego spacecraft and doing little, like, theatrical performances. That's nerd as fuck. But, all right, guys. So, this nerdy stuff, that is just one aspect of your show. Now, I want to talk briefly about, the other. When did you guys decide that you wanted to study politics and political science?
Well, I'll answer first. I was actually, I'm trying to remember, because I didn't know what I wanted to study. When I finished high school...
That's hardly surprising.
Yeah, I didn't know what the hell was going on. I still don't know what's going on with my life. when I finished high school, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I only just barely scraped through my final exams in high school. Just got into university. So I thought, like, maybe I should just, like, take some time off and get my shit together. And I went traveling. I went to live in London for 2.5 years. And in that time, I started to get interested in British politics. And I just remember having, like, a very strong interest in what was going on, so, like, following the electoral system. And I actually enjoyed watching the speeches in British Parliament. And living in London, it was cool because I could actually go every now and then. We sometimes went down to Westminster and actually got to sit in the Parliament when they were, discussing and having question time, which is fun. But when I got to – when I started studying, because I had to go back to South Africa to study – I was actually going to do my undergrad in anthropology. But it turned out that the University of Pretoria, which is both mine and Brock's undergrad alma mater, we didn't have a set degree in anthropology. It just had a general BA, of which one of the subjects could be anthropology. And I remember somebody telling me, like, it looks much better to have a degree, like, in something specialized. And then one of the things was you could do a degree in political science, and it was political science and international relations. And you could have anthropology as one of your electives. But when I started studying political science, I was like, this is exactly what I want to do with my life. Screw anthropology. So that's how I got
wise decision.
Yeah. Although now, in my work, I actually do a lot of political anthropology. I still deal with a lot of anthropological stuff. Brock, stop hating, okay? It's just... And just don't hate on somebody who's better than you. Okay, it's just okay.
Anthropology is just not better than me. No, mine's less career oriented. I was just trying to figure out what's going to make the world a better place, and I figured political science is what can help inform policy in Africa. So I'm going to stick it to that and hopefully make a difference in someone's life. And that's probably the most direct route to take. When I found out University of Pretoria is offering a specialized course in political science, as opposed to all the other universities in South Africa, then that just seemed like the obvious choice for the undergrad, and obviously to, you know, specialize outside of South Africa was the next step. So that's where Peter and I met.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, why don't you tell us about that meeting of the minds?
At the British Parliamentary debating. So we had a society on campus that encouraged four teams to compete on either side of the house, in a, you know, typical parliamentary style as occurs in Westminster. And because it's teams of two, since Peter and I were both studying politics, we figured we'd understand arguments the same way, and it would cut down on our prep times. You only get 15 minutes to prepare for a motion. It would make sense if, you know, we'd be really efficient if we could prepare our arguments while cutting out and using a lot of jargon. We wouldn't have to explain things to each other. Say if he was an anthropologist, then, you know, that would take a lot of time to prepare. And we got along and we enjoyed some success doing that. And obviously when you're sitting around waiting most debating tournaments, you just spend a lot of time waiting. And, in all that free time that we had, we debated, which universe would be best for a post-scarcity resource society. You know, how would the economy work in Harry Potter's universe? Which Avenger would be most suited to serve on the United Nations Security Council? And those kinds of debates gave us good entertainment and a lot of intellectual stimulation. So, the friendship formed and stuck and is still going.
Yeah, yeah. And I think because I took gap years, I was in first year when you were in second year. Even though Brock's a little bit younger than me.
Only in age.
And in just everything. It's I feel sometimes like I'm Brock's dad. Like I just look after him. but yeah, when we started debating. Although in the beginning, I think our first tournament that we went to, we weren't partners. But we were both pissed off with the partners that we did have at that tournament. So, then we ended up partnering up. And for the rest of our debating career, until Brock left university, we were debating partners, which was pretty fun.
And we also, what was the other stuff we did? We got involved in student parliament together.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Oh, yeah, because Brock and I both ran for political office in student politics, and Brock, I think that you got a seat, and then I was the speaker for the house. Oh, what a terrible time of my life! I'm like, oh, I got post traumatic stress disorder from that. I never want to get into that again. Yeah.
So we did that together as well.
Oh, that's awesome. So, needless to say, the political world can often be a grim place, and I think that brings me to my next point about Lands of Leviathan. Because the one thing I really love about it is the intersection of reality and fantasy. So if, for example, the discussion is about authoritarian regime types, instead of citing, you know, brutal historical or contemporary dictators like Stalin or Kim Jong-un, you can provide listeners that little bit of an escape and allow them to consider the substance of your concepts in a context without all the real-world human suffering needing to really be part of it. So, you know, you can move that conversation to the zombie apocalypse and utilize the Rictatorship as an example. And I think that's really neat. So, Brock, you'd mentioned kind of talking about those, you know, the Jedi Council, UN type things, you know, fooling around in that debate league. But when did you guys decide to make this a podcast concept?
Well, we had been discussing professional goals for a while. Peter and I trying to figure out where we would fit as policy analysts in our future careers and how we could work together. But we knew that that would take some lengthy postgraduate studies. And in that time, I was doing my... We'd also always talked about how you get these debates on air to share via mainstream media, via online media. And when I was doing my master's in Germany last year, and Peter also hit his gender studies and development full swing, all these debates from our undergrad came up again. And so, we were allowed the comfort to recede back into our academic chairs and entertain our, you know, our student mindsets again that we'd forgotten in the brief periods that we had been working. So in that time, about a year ago, we thought, well, actually, hang on, let's make this podcast real, you know, stop talking about it. It could be a good opportunity to test the ideas we've been using that, that would compare political ideas and philosophies and ideologies and all the other parts of political science, but in a fictitious, science fiction world. Use the space to test these ideas, and hopefully that can somehow get us to understand better what we're trying to do in our careers. So it was a meeting of those three forces last year that that helped us form this.
Mm. And I think another thing is, I've been listening to podcasts for a while, for at least a good couple of years, and they're really a good avenue for explaining different concepts and making people aware of different news and shattering myths and things like
and
that.
Debunking myths, we love
that. Yeah, and that was one of the things is that, like, you know, politics can be depressing, but when you start looking at politics from a historical point of view, when you zoom out a bit, you start to notice other trends that sometimes aren't that depressing. Like, obviously, there's the terrible authoritarian regimes, but there's sometimes been authoritarian regimes that not that bad. And there are, you know, absolute monarchies that have existed in Europe where, you know, the majority of the time it was okay. Maybe not the greatest, but not too bad. And I think one of the reasons we went through popular culture, not just because we knew a lot about it, but also because popular culture is a representation of the way that we perceive politics. And politics in popular culture is horrible. It's just the worst. Yeah. Like, that's why House of Cards was one of our first podcasts, because that view of politics is just like, this is terrible. And we kind of wanted to shatter that a bit and say, you know what, politics is not that bad. Obviously, it's got its terribleness, but it's not as bad.
What? Sorry, is that a real word?
Terribleness is totally a word. Stop correcting my English. politics is not as bad as people think, and it's obviously a force for good. And I think Brock and I have had a little bit of criticism from people saying that we're sometimes a little bit too, apologist about politics.
Yeah, it is like, there are a few other reasons as well. The fiction that comes through in popular culture, like Peter says, it can crystallize stereotypes, and you want to debunk those as a political scientist. You want to show how they oversimplify the nuances that, you know, in regular political behavior and phenomenon. But what's more is the science fiction can also bring out the fun in politics. So, you know, politics can be terribly, not just depressing and ugly, but also just boring. Mm. And you get to see that, you know, from the view of a zombie or a lightsaber, that just makes it a lot more interesting. And condensed into a 60-minute episode, it can make politics a lot more fun.
Yeah.
So there was that attraction and the appeal of popular culture that could make, you know, the dreariness of political phenomena a lot more exciting. And lastly, the other thing I wanted to add was it certainly gets me excited, because when I engage with people who don't pay a lot of attention to politics and express their decision not to, but yet they still want to find out your opinion and they still want to sort of reify their stereotypes and their shadow heuristics. You find yourself just sort of obeying to, you know, to what they want to hear, just to shut them up. And I think that's, it's just unfair to your opinions. You know, you'd want a good 60 minutes that if anybody wants to listen, not that they had to, but if they wanted to, that could be the space to say, this is actually what's going on in my opinion. And if you don't want to listen to it, that's okay. But I'm not going to just give you the 5-minute version of what I think you want to hear so that you'll shut up. It's just unfair on the reality. So to avoid contorted opinions and warped mindsets, I think this podcast was a good opportunity to give myself the space I feel I needed to say the things I wanted to say about politics.
Now, I was wondering, have you guys ever read Tolkien's essay on fairy stories?
I have not, but I've heard it's so good.
Go ahead, Pete, I'm sorry.
I think I did read it. I it's ringing a whole bunch of bells, but I think it was many, many, many years ago. It was, if I'm not wrong, it's like his analysis of the British, English fairy mythology, the whole interactions between fairies and iron and all the different types of fairies and things like that.
It touches on that, but it also is a bit of a literary analysis about like what makes like a really good fantasy story. And it's something that always comes to mind when I listen to Lands of Leviathan. So I'm going to just take a second and briefly describe it for you guys and the listeners. So basically he says the best fantasy doesn't actually require a reader, or in this case a listener, to suspend their disbelief. But if you create a fictional world that's internally consistent and logical, the author can then create what he terms second belief. And then you can kind of naturally build in things like zombies or dragons into the DNA of the bones of the world that you're creating. And you're still, the reader knows that this isn't real, but you're not actually forcing him to suspend disbelief, because within the context of that world, this is still believable. And if you successfully build that, he contends that it allows the reader then to review their own world, meaning the real world, from the perspective of that creative world. And thereby you can recover your own mind from your everyday biases and presuppositions and be more open to the possibility of having their minds changed in some basic way, basically by being given this fresh pair of eyes to look at their own world through. So are you guys still with me?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, okay. I'm listening intently.
Yeah, so I've always sort of felt that way when listening to Lands of Leviathan, because the best fantasy worlds that you guys pick, you know, ones like Walking Dead, Westeros, Star Trek, Star Wars, and certainly I think the Tolkien worlds, they have that. They're very logically consistent, and I think they do create that second belief. And I think that makes them a much stronger vehicle for you using and plugging in these real-world examples. So that's my long-winded way of asking, what goes into your selection of these worlds and these topic pairings that you choose? Is something like this part of it? Because, like, The Walking Dead really works for certain things, but something like Gulliver's Travels or Alice in Wonderland just wouldn't work, because those things are, like, they make no sense at all.
I think,
and they lend themselves less easily to political analysis.
Well, I mean, Gulliver's Travel is an interesting thing, because that is a, I mean, Gulliver's Travel was written as an analogy of colonialism. We should probably take that on at some point. But, Brock, do you mind if I go first?
Well, I would just say, Tolkien would say Gulliver's Travel is so heavily allegorical that you can't do anything but that which it was written about.
Exactly. Yes. Like, well, that's, yeah, I think Gulliver's Travels was written as an allegory. Like, the author was really to make a point. And, I mean, there are points that Tolkien makes, you know, industrialization versus traditionalism. But, yeah, definitely. So I think that from what you were saying, like what Tolkien expresses there is conversations that Brock and I had when we were first formulating the podcast. And one of the conversations that we had where we talked about universal rules. And because a lot of people don't have fun and seem to get upset when you do this, but I love dissecting universes and the rules that the authors and creators have established, and then subjecting that universe to its own rules and then seeing where it falls apart. So, you know, a fictional universe doesn't have to adhere to our rules, because obviously that doesn't work. So in the case of a zombie apocalypse, the implicit assumption is this is a universe in which a virus can exist that can do this to the human body. And anybody who then makes the, criticism of like, oh, well, the dead can't walk around because that body is dead. It's like, yeah, but that's in our world. In this fictional world, there's the implicit assumption that that's possible. So we don't even have to deal with that. But we accept all the rules within that universe, and then we can have fun with the fact that now we can play around with it. So I think the Harry Potter universe is a good example of this, because the Harry Potter universe is...
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know, J.K. Rowling is very good at writing dialogue and establishing characters. She's terrible at establishing universe building, because her rules don't make much sense. So she establishes an economy in a universe that shouldn't really have an economy, because wizards have the ability to create natural resources out of nothing. So, we know that in that universe there is somebody who has the magical ability to transmute stuff into gold. Like, yeah, it's difficult, but I mean, we made nuclear bombs. That was difficult, but we didn't hold us back. So, you know, there's no reason that
look at us go.
Yeah. There's no reason that conflict should exist in that universe. And when you open up that discussion, then you can have a lot of fun and you can explain economic concepts. You know, you can start looking at supply and demand. And that's what we did in our episode on Star Trek, because obviously Gene Roddenberry created a universe that he did think out quite nicely, and he created a society that was utopian, his version of the perfect society, and he created a society with no material needs. And from that, we were then able to discuss economics. What effect would that have on society and things like that? So, yeah, I agree with what you've said. We engage with the rules and regulations that are set up by the author. And it's just before, Brock, I'm sure you've got stuff to say, but I'd like to say about Tolkien, because there is obviously the famous plot hole in Tolkien's work, which was, you know, why didn't the eagles just fly Frodo and them to Mount Doom? And I know that in the books, he attempts to, because it's not Gandalf who controls the eagles, it's Radagast the Brown. But, you know, as Gandalf, I would just say, like, you're an intelligent wizard, dude. You're essentially an angel. You know what's going on. Just go get some eagles and travel to Mount Doom. You can do it. We know that you have the power. Or go find Radagast. You know, like, rather go send the Fellowship of the Ring to find that dude than walk to Mordor, because that seems crazy. So it's funny that Tolkien himself probably, you know, but I suppose when you're constructing a fictional universe, there are always going to be some plot holes.
There are, but I didn't find that one tremendously persuasive, because
the eagles have their own agency. It's not like they listen to anybody. They have their own king. They have their own political system.
Yeah, but I mean, the world is at stake here. This is not like, you know, if Sauron wins, everybody gets owned. It's, you know,
Denethor didn't get that. Why should the King of the Eagles get that?
Well, you would hope Denethor was insane.
Where he didn't help out at the Battle of Minas Tirith, then why would they, you know, get involved? Why would they want to take on 9 winged ringwraiths?
But they did at the end. They came and helped out. So,
and they came to the Battle of the 5 Armies in The Hobbit as well.
Yeah, so Tolkien definitely used the eagles as a deus ex machina.
No, he used them as rescue agents, right? Those are like flying ambulances. Yeah. That's literally the definition of
deus ex machina.
When you guys read the Silmarillion, you'll get that they work for Manwë, one of the Valar.
Yeah,
if you don't get that reference now, then you will then.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. But you can see how already this is, you know, there is a confrontation that's open up for discussion. And now there's a possibility that we could compare the different political systems of the eagles and everybody else and use that as a window to discuss different political systems in our own world. So that is what Brock and I do. We have longstanding debates that still have not been cleared.
Well, to bring a little more structure to Peter's answer, because as usual, you have to let the child have his way first,
and then
I can sort of make sense of what he said. It took us about, let's say, 10 episodes, or maybe 15, to actually get down to we knew between ourselves what the Lands of Leviathan meant as a space for debate, but it wasn't really crystallized in the format of each episode. And so we developed we take great pride in the fact that we don't script any of our episodes. We don't have anything lined up in particular of what we're going to say. We just have a theme and a topic, and that's it. And it came out from realizing that each time we discuss something, we want to set that first understanding. I think what Tolkien would refer to is, you know, that first belief system where you've got that skeletal bone structure of a story, and that in our episodes comes across normally in the form of a political concept that we want to explain and test and debate about. And that forms the ground in which we will place a supernatural or fictional world where we'll play out with, you know, little figurines, the more fun aspects of what we think would be possible in that world. And that's the topic, or that's the film or the TV franchise, whatever it is we want to discuss. And so within that structure, we realized that, okay, so actually what the Lands of Leviathan means to us is it's a land in which political theories and concepts are tested against each other using the fictional flexibility of popular culture and fictional and worlds that have been created, you know, in imaginative spaces. So it's using things like Avatar and the Na'vi and the different type and the unique sort of colonial structure we saw there to test whether or not we think colonialism is accurately represented as a concept there and how it has been represented in the past in our own world. So I like that you used the analogy of Tolkien's sort of dual layer of beliefs, that you had the bone structure but on top of that you allow the reader to impress themselves upon the story, but yet not have to do it in such a way that it would challenge their fundamental beliefs, so they could still have their own unique imaginative experience there.
And I think that the way that we pick as well, I mean, it works both ways. There'll be some weeks where, you know, we'll watch a movie or be watching a TV series, and I'll just think, and Brock will just think, hey, this is a good example of this idea. So we'll work from the popular culture to the political idea. And then other times we'll be reading a news article or listening to a lecture or doing our own academic work and be like, this is a really cool idea to tackle. Let's find a popular culture where it's displayed. Sometimes that's a lot more difficult because you're dealing with a nuanced concept that now you have to find a popular culture or character that you can explain it through.
Sometimes it's more fun to do it that way, because we found that those nuanced concepts, you can't find an example in popular culture that fits quite uniquely that would, you know, it would fill a healthy chunk of an episode. So you have to sort of float the idea through various different illustrations in popular culture. So you, you end up using many different examples, and that normally lends itself to good debate. And you can take the concept through its various spectrums of understanding. So those different interpretations are quite fun.
Now, what are some worlds you guys haven't visited yet in your podcast that you hope to do something with in the future, if that's not giving too much away?
I'm trying to think.
We haven't started our series on ideologies yet. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to find a fitting popular cultural theme that will lend itself easily to each ideology. So you don't want to just take, let's say, conservatism and say, right, this is a world in which we can describe the political regime as conservative. We want to try and make it a bit more fun and a bit more accurate. We're trying to find a way to do it in such with more personality and with more customizability. So maybe something more like using different characters. Mm. If we find different characters, we can span different political, different popular cultural themes and different shows, but at the same time still stick truly to the type of the particular ideology you want to do in that episode. It also give us, you know, quite a bit of content to develop in the future, because if you do conservatism 1 month, the next month you can do socialism, and the month after that you can do libertarianism, whatever. We've also got, we haven't touched on Harry Potter at all, and that's still waiting. We're waiting for our guest speaker to avail themselves for that one. We've got a few that we still want to do with X-Men and Avengers. They always lend themselves quite easily, and we try and use those kinds of themes to rather fit the topic for that week. So we'd rather say, right, we're going to talk about X-Men this week. What do we want to bring out of that? Rather than saying, I want to talk about the presidential debate in the US, which theme are we going to use for that? Mm. They give us quite a bit to work with.
And obviously, I mean, there are some universes that we've only just touched on. We've spoken about the Battlestar Galactica universe, but very briefly. In a couple of our episodes. So, like, that's one that I would like to get more into, because the relationship between, the military and the government is very interesting. The relationship between science and the government, the use of technology. And, there's also some popular culture that we are not so good at. You know, we know a lot about comic book stuff. Well, we know a lot about superheroes, but most of that stuff, I think for me, and I think for, I don't know, Brock, if you read comics when you were a kid, but most of that stuff for me comes from the movies and stuff, because growing up in South Africa, comic books, superhero comic books were very expensive. So we couldn't afford that stuff. But that stuff I would like to break into a lot more. So definitely X-Men, as Brock said, we haven't touched. And there's a couple, we've had conversations with a couple of people who have asked us to break into tabletop games. So like Warhammer, 40K, and Dungeons & Dragons, and things like that. And that's left, like, that's a big gap, I think, in a Brockenized nerd culture, because we haven't played that. We didn't play that much. We were much more of computer game guys. Mm. So we were playing RPGs on computers. But I think there's tons of stuff that we can still explore. I mean, I don't think we're anywhere close to running out of stuff to explore, and obviously there's tons of concepts that we can explore. Like, we still want to do stuff on like political feminism, political green movement ideologies. So yeah, that's I think where we're going, but we also tend to wing it quite a bit.
Yeah, and we also try to keep a little flexibility for current affairs and current topics. You know, we got about 6 weeks to prepare for the Brexit referendum. You know, we know the presidential debate's coming up. We know that Ban Ki-moon's about to find a replacement in the UN Secretariat. So those kinds of things we need to just keep in our calendars. And we, as much as we would want to do, for example, an episode on Lost, the TV show, and social identity theory, that'll have to wait if Trump has a major victory against Hillary during the week. So there's a bit of flexibility. But I'd say formally, what listeners can look forward to, the worlds that we definitely be touching on soon, is Harry Potter, Battlestar Galactica,
X-Men.
And then some, X-Men definitely, and superheroes.
Cool. Now, just to wrap things up today, you guys, as we mentioned several times, are South African. And besides you two, the only other South Africans I'm, honestly even aware of are, Nelson Mandela, Dave Matthews, God help
us. Hey, yay, I love Dave.
I don't even know who that is.
What?
You're
Dave
lucky.
Matthews, Dave Matthews Band. I don't know why everybody hates Dave Matthews Band so much. Oh. Crash Into Me, it's cool, man.
Is it a musical? Is it?
Yeah, Dave Matthews Band. I reckon you'd like him.
Oh, no.
The villains from Lethal Weapon 2 were also South African. And Trevor Noah. So I think needless to say, I'd be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to ask about it. Not unlike the United States, South Africa is a nation with a colonial foundation that's had a bit of a controversial history concerning racial relations.
That's putting it lightly.
That's putting it very, very mildly. So, yourselves were very young towards the end of the apartheid regime before it collapsed. And I'm a little bit older. And one of my early political memories is the magnitude of Mandela's election in 94. But if you would, could you combine your powers of political science and international relations and give the listeners your personal and professional impressions on the state of South Africa, which is, I think, currently Africa's second or third largest economy?
It's actually the first. We jumped back up recently.
You jumped back up. Oh, way to go, guys.
That wasn't me. I didn't do it. I'm in Australia. Brock, you go first so that I can tear your answer apart when you're done.
Okay. So this is a question about the current state of South Africa.
Yeah.
How much time do we have?
As long as you want, man.
I have to try and stay positive. I'm a natural pessimist. And let's try and keep it professional. As far as party politics goes, let's focus on the ruling party, the African National Congress, who's been in power since 1994. That was Nelson Mandela's party. Now our president is a crony capitalist who's abusing state powers and funds to keep himself in power and to keep his cohort in power until the national election in 2019. What many people feel is, or let's say what the average sentiment in South Africa is that the ANC has had a good run. They need another chance. And this is now going on majoritarian electorate statistics. We just need a different leader. So many people are upset with the current leader of the ANC, Jacob Zuma, and the president of the country, and would rather see him replaced within the ANC while the ANC stays in power. There is a significant and growing opposition faction that's saying, for South Africa to do better and to make optimal use of our resources, especially our mining capabilities, we need a different ruling party. So the ANC actually needs to step down in 2019 or lose the elections after 25 years of being in power, since they haven't done as much as they could have done. They have come nowhere close to the potential. Certainly they haven't come anywhere close to the promises that were made in the 90s. We need to do everything in our power to get that right. Now, what do we mean by everything in our power? Because the ANC is still the majority, still enjoys the majority of support. And how does that change? Well, because the party will have its national meeting, its big meeting in 2017 to choose its next leaders, most people would say, okay, so that's the time at which the ANC needs to recall Jacob Zuma. He's bad for the party's image. He's going to tarnish their electoral chances in 2019. Let's find his replacement then. But given how bad he's doing, how poorly he's performing, it might be better for South Africa as a country, not for the party, for Jacob Zuma to stay as the leader of the ANC, for him to be in power until 2019, for him to continue to run amok, and thereby bring the ANC down with him, giving an opposition party a chance to win the national election 2019 and ensure some change and a new shot at South Africa reaching its potential. That, however, the problem with that argument is that the way Jacob Zuma is going, he's going to do a lot of damage to the country. He's going to do a lot of damage to the economy, to the currency, to the foreign exchange reserves, to our general economic capacity. That's going to hurt our lending status. It's going to hurt our trading partners. And so we won't come out of that looking very good. It'll certainly set up the new ruling party with a heck of a lot of work to do in 2019. So South Africa is not reaching its potential. The chances of it ever reaching its potential are slim. And some people say that it's either going to happen by the current ruling party getting its act together and electing a new leader, or by the new leader dragging down the current party and allowing an opposition party a chance to have a go at running the country better.
Yeah, and I agree with Brock on all those points, except for the pessimistic one right at the end, because I'm sure that if anybody's listened to a podcast knows that I tend to be, well, I am a liberal, Brock is the conservative, which is why we have such good debates on many political issues, and I tend to be more optimistic, sometimes foolishly, about things. But I also, from a political analysis point of view, I take a very long-term historical viewpoint of what's happening, you know, in politics in general. And that goes into my view on South Africa as well. So Jacob Zuma, who is the president at the moment, is a terrible, crony capitalist. He's doing very badly for the economy and the ANC in general as well. But if you look back to the arguments being made now, by people in the ANC against Zuma, they're very similar to the arguments that were being made by people in Zuma's camp when he ousted his former president, Thabo Mbeki. It was different circumstances, but it's a power outage. I think that Jacob Zuma's probably made some very bad political decisions in terms of maintaining power within the ANC. I don't think that from the point of view of the country, bringing in another ANC member to be president is going to make much of a difference. What I think is it's very necessary for a change in leadership, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter which political party is in power. Once you've been in power for 25 years, the chances of political corruption are incredibly high. The correlation for terms in office and political corruption are there. You know, it's one of the things as political scientists we've known for ages, and one of the reasons why we install term limits. But one of the biggest issues in South Africa is that the executive and the legislature are controlled by the ANC, and a certain percentage of the judiciary is as well. So there's a large amount of scope for political corruption. Now, that being said, there's also a large amount of shakeup happening at the moment. So this year we had the municipal elections, which I suppose the equivalent in America would be, you know, the midterm elections to put the senators in place. So it elects the leadership of the different provinces and the different municipalities within that province. And the Democratic Alliance, which is the primary opposition, took some very important key areas. So Brock, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're actually there, but I believe they took Johannesburg, which is the major city in South Africa. It's where all the economics go through. They didn't manage to take Pretoria, but only...
They got Pretoria.
Oh, they did. Okay. So they took Pretoria, which is one of the capitals, because South Africa has three, because we like to do things differently. But if you look at the large-term track, the DA has been winning more and more power year on year in election years. They expect that they will win the national election in 2019. And I think that's to a large extent because of the fact that the generation that is voting now aren't that concerned about apartheid politics anymore. So, you know, I was 7 years old. Well, apartheid officially, technically ended in 1990 when Mandela was released from prison. And at that point, I was four. I'm 30 this year. So you could imagine, like, people who were 21, they were born in a time when apartheid didn't exist. So they're coming out and they're voting now, and they're voting, they're voting using their economic, they want better economic opportunities. They want jobs. South Africa has an incredibly high unemployment rate. And we have a very high percentage of educated population as well, though. You know, people coming out of universities, a lot of like young urban people who want good opportunities, and that's what they're asking for. And I think that that's what you're going to see in the next couple of years is a big change in South Africa. And I think it's going to be for the best, as long as the DA also doesn't become a powerhouse of crony capitalism. But one would hope not.
It's kind of like if you're sitting in Essos and you're watching the Lannisters destroy Westeros, and you're just wondering how much more damage they need to do before Daenerys takes her chance.
Yeah.
And flies in on her dragons.
Yeah.
It's just
come now.
You know, yeah. At some point, you know, for even the mild Lannister supporters, you kind of want them to lose faith in their own rulers first before Daenerys can seize power with 100% legitimacy. So it's a matter of waiting and seeing how much damage they can do, you know, before things can change in the long term.
Yep.
Well, that's a pretty nice analogy to end on. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And
awesome.
I had a great time. I hope you guys enjoyed yourselves as well.
Yeah.
It's always good to reflect on this stuff, Tom. Thanks so much for the opportunity. It gives us some clarity on the show's intentions.
Happy to provide that. Do you guys want to give any plugs before you go?
So just normal plugs. Find the Lands of Leviathan. We've got our website, landsofleviathan.com. We love hearing back from our listeners at landsofleviathan@gmail.com. And we're on Facebook and Twitter at Lands of Leviathan. And obviously, we are part of the Agora Podcast Network, and we're hosted on Acast. So come and have a listen, guys. We are building up.
One
last thing.
One last thing is, if you've got any intention of buying books off Amazon, we've got a direct link for you to go ahead and set up an account. And if it goes through this link, it's audibletrial.com/LOL. And if you sign up to the Audible service, then Lands of Leviathan gets some support from that. So make use of it.
Okay, guys. Thanks again.
Awesome. Thanks Tom.
Bye-bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.